Spencer, I'm an addict.
Hey, Spencer.
Hug a big, sweaty guy. Help me get out of myself. Open this meeting again with me with the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Thank you all for coming out on like a 99 degree day with 300% humidity. And I wish you could have heard the lead I gave in the car with air conditioning on the way up here. I wish I would have recorded it, and then I wouldn't have to speak. I can't tell you that this is like warm and fuzzy and comfortable to share your message, because the longer I've been around, like the longer my story gets, and you end up with just pieces of highlights along the way. I listened to that young lady, Sarah, speak, said like, wow, she's really heavy, you know? She had a really good message. How are they going to like me? And, you know, if you read just for today's reading today, in the book, you know, it's about low self-esteem, and it's about peeling off the layers from the mask that we wear in recovery and that we wore in addiction. It really made me think today, and I'm glad I read it, because all my life I've worn masks. It's just kind of one of the things I did to survive and get by. My clean date is February 7th of 1993. I've been clean almost 17 and a half years. But for the grace of God, like, I just came here for the day. And somehow I'm getting old. And I don't know what old-timers are, you know, but yeah, I remember going to meetings when I was new, and, like, there was this meeting in Homestead at this recovery club, and they called it the old-timers meeting. You had to have 5 years to share. It's like, how did somebody get 5 years? And I went to this AA, not too long ago, I went to this AA old-timers meeting. You had to have 20 years to share. And there were like 100 people there with more than 20 years. I'm like, how do you get 20 years? I'm happy to be where I am today. I'm happy to be clean today. My life's just a miracle, and one after another. And yeah, I'll tell you a little bit about my story. Like I said, I can only give you highlights. You don't want to stay that long. I'm a product of what I think is a great family. You know, we all, it's different on every, you know, down on every house, on every side of the street. Life's always different. You don't know what's going on behind somebody else's door, but I know what was going on behind ours. And when I tell you that, like, I had good parents, and I had a brother and a sister, and we had a good home, we traveled a lot, and as more gets revealed, my dad was a business consultant to organized crime. I don't know a better way to put it. We were like a mob family growing up. And my dad was famous but not so famous in that world. And I grew up like going back and forth to Vegas, and we'd sit front and center with Sammy Davis Jr. and Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra, and he knew all those guys personally, and it was just the life we led. We lived in Beverly Hills. I was born in New York. We left New York. My dad was something to do with stock market, and I guess now they call things like insider trading and all that stuff, but we left New York and moved out to Beverly Hills, like Beverly Hillbillies. But where my story, you know, begins is like I was 2 years old playing in our driveway, and I got run over by our family car, and I did it all myself. So everything, life changed, but that's just life, you know. I didn't know no better. So I think I know I was a handicapped child. You know, I didn't really walk till I was about 8 years old. I got run over pretty good. And my parents, they wanted to take off my legs. My parents said maybe we should get another opinion. And we went to, you know, the best of surgeons, and they put me back together. And eventually, you know, I could walk. Got my first bicycle and all that when I was about 8. And I went to school for, back then it was school for crippled kids. You know, now those words ain't politically correct, but went to school for handicapped children, and most of them were handicapped in the mind, and I was handicapped in the body. So it led them to spend more time with me because I could learn, and I ended up doing good in school and moving forward. I even like skipped third grade. And eventually, you know, we left California. We lived in Oklahoma for a while. And I remember moving to Oklahoma, and they said, like, man, we never seen Jewish people before. We didn't know what they looked like. So, you know, not to say, like, what's different, you know. I always think of the differences and forget about the similarities between me and other people, you know. Today I'm just a squirrel trying to get a nut, you know. Trying to stay clean. But I grew up. You know, we moved from Oklahoma to Baltimore to Chicago, but I grew up in Pittsburgh. We moved here in about 1970, and I was in about eighth grade. And so I say that I grew up in Pittsburgh because I became aware and became an adult in Pittsburgh. And we lived on a nice, quiet street with all kind of kids to play with, and stick ball and wall ball, and had fun. And I think at that point in my life, I think I wanted to be anywhere but in my home. I wanted to be in your house. I wanted to be breaking into your garage. I wanted to be opening up your car at night and see what's in it, you know. And I think, yeah, I had some tendencies, but I was just part of growing up for me, you know. Steal all your pop bottles and return them, you know, take them back and get the money. And I think I pulled my first major criminal activity, and I was about 13 years old, and kind of vandalized, burglarized a gas station, took a lot of money, and I bought a go-kart. me and my partner in crime bought a go-kart. You know, I don't know where, like, addiction begins. I know that there's a lot of behaviors associated, but I was just a kid having fun, doing things with other kids. And there's a lot of kids on our street. And yeah, maybe the older kids had already, like, found their taste of not addiction, but, you know, drugs on our street. You know, there were already some mixed up children on our street. I said, oh, Michael, he's a very mixed up young man, you know. For a while there, I didn't realize why we were playing ball outside, why everybody wanted to use our bathroom. Like, what made our bathroom so special? It was because we had a medicine cabinet filled with pills. And I didn't learn that till a little bit later, why our bathroom was so good. You know, everybody's got bathrooms, why ours? Yeah, I started partying. I started getting stoned. I was about 15 years old. I remember the ritual, you know, this group of guys, and hovering down in my buddy Neil's basement, and we had this tiny little brass pipe, and pass around that little, and then we'd eat a box of frozen ho-hos, frozen Hostess cupcakes. We had a blast getting stoned. Times were good then. And I've always been a little bit enterprising. I learned quickly that drugs are bought and sold every day, and I started selling drugs at a very young age. I was in high school. I became the guy, you know. Come to me for anything. I was the 70s. I was a hippie. I was just one of them little hippie kids with long hair and a ponytail and no ambition and no drive, and I didn't want to be anything when I grew up. My parents, up until I got clean, my parents used to say I had the Peter Pan syndrome. Like, I was just a kid who never wanted to grow up. And I can tell you that in advance, like, I don't think I grew up until I got here. I didn't have anything going on but a life that said if I didn't make it another day, it really didn't matter. Nothing mattered. I wasn't going to leave an impact or a mark on society. I didn't become a piece of shit, you know, on people's shoes yet, but I was destined down a path. Uh,
Well, I turned about 12, and I had to have some more surgery on my hip. And at the same time, my older brother, my older brother and sister always had some problem. Like, you know, I'm blessed with like four children, and I think of like, they're all cool. But my parents, what they had to deal with, my childhood handicap. And when I was 12, my older brother, like, and we thought what everybody thought were emotional problems, but it turns out he had a brain tumor. And he got very, life changed at home. He had a humongous brain tumor. Like maybe like if they had diagnostics today, then like they have today, things would have been different. But my parents thought it'd be better. I was going to graduate from high school, and they sent me off to college because they needed me close, but they needed me out of the house for all the things that they had to deal with. And I went away to college, and I became, you know, that got that freedom. I had freedom at home. I'm going to tell you that I sold weed from home. I was in with mob guys from Youngstown. I'd buy large quantities of marijuana. My parents would find it, and they wouldn't bother with it. And I was allowed to smoke pot at home because we lived around the corner from a police station. My parents thought it'd be better if I did it at home and did it out behind the house. If I did behind the house, I'd be in the police station's backyard. I think my first bust was selling fireworks when I was like 12 also, when the police raid your house for fireworks. But yeah, I went away to this little college, and I became like a big fish in a small pond. I was like the sole white water acid dealer at my college, and it was, I felt so important to be out on a weekend night. Everybody's tripping on my acid. Times were fun, and I kept a safety deposit box at the bank full of acid and money, and they thought I was a craftsman also. I did custom leather craft. I'm not as my cover, but that was my cover. Like, I had these diamond tip tools, and I had to keep them in a safety deposit. I can't believe that bank let me, this 17-year-old kid, in and out of their vault every day. I can't believe I got away with it. There's a whole lot of things I can't believe I got away with. And at college, like, we'd wait for those big drug raids, and I never got raided. I never got caught. After 2 years of that little college, Little California, PA, I transferred to Penn State main campus and State College, and I became a small fish in a big pond. So I was still just a happy-go-lucky hippie kid. It was nice to go out and like find yourself a new girlfriend every night of the week. It really was. The 70s times were different. I majored in like frisbee, skateboard, acid, hanging out. I learned something because I do have a bachelor's degree, and I did keep my scholarship the whole way through, but I didn't learn nothing. I had a really good time though. I graduated from college, and I wanted to live out some of my dreams, and I went to live out in Colorado. They put me together pretty well at that point. It's falling apart again, but it's a whole other story. But I wanted to be a ski bum and live in Aspen among the rich and famous. And we were just the guys who worked in this town. You know, we weren't rich. We weren't famous. I still got a lot of play there, and we fell in with the right crowd there. Ended up being a, yes, after that movie Drugstore Cowboy come out, we were kind of like drugstore cowboys out there, and that's where I got my first taste of injectable narcotics. And that's where, you know, a line in the sand gets drawn, you know, when somebody puts a needle in your arm for the first time, and that was it. I found what I was looking for.
And we had an unlimited supply of drugs. We called it our, back at Blues Brothers time, we had our briefcase full of blues. And we hung out, and it was just so much fun. We met in with the Coke crowd, and so we could parlay this for that and speedball. So that brought the speedball into the equation, if anybody knew what that was. But you know, in those days, times were different. Like, they didn't have, like, security cams, alarm systems, CSI units. We didn't get caught, but I couldn't finish the season out there, and we had to come home. And somewhere in hindsight, it's like, come home before you get caught, because they're going to figure this shit out, you know? You can't hide. You can't hide it that well, the lifestyle that you're living, the people that you're... It's a small town. Aspen's a small town. I come home, and my older brother was really sick. He was nearing the end of his road. So I came home to be with my family. And yeah, I remember when I got home, this we're talking about like 1979 now, 1980, I don't remember. And I came home, and you know, there was a girl I left at college that I thought I would marry someday. She had another year of college remaining, and I found that new love. You know, I didn't need her anymore. You know, I had, like, delauded. So I found what I was looking for. And in hindsight also, you know, her parents owned, like, half of Philadelphia, and I would have been, like, set, but how could I have held on to that, because I didn't know where I was, what I was doing, and I wasn't ready to grow up yet anyway. So I came home to take care of what I needed to do, and remember when I got home, you know, I was like changed. My parents could see, like, you've changed. Like, not like I've grown up or I've matured, it's like I've just changed. And they thought I needed to get away, so they sent me to a relative, had a place at Ocean City, Maryland, and I went to stay at their place by myself. And of course, I took everything with me, including me. And I got there, and I, lo and behold, my shit, my uncle was a diabetic. I got there, and there were syringes, like there, new ones. Because this whole season in Colorado, we only had like one. I think we broke in and forgot to take the syringes, you know, because we had like one. Well, I learned how to be Dr. Spencer at that point, and had a wonderful time. When I came back from the beach, my parents thought I needed some kind of help. They didn't know anything about drugs or addiction or anything. So they sent me, Mom took me to Western Psych, and I don't know if I needed somebody to talk to. I went there anyway. And when I sat down with like an intake or a counselor there and told them kind of like what was going on, they thought like I should stay there. Like, do you have your suitcase? Do you have your stuff with you? It's like, no, I didn't come here for that. I came here like for a prescription. Like, maybe you could write me a prescription for something else to make me okay. You know, I told you, I didn't know nothing. And they didn't write me no prescription, but they did tell me about these meetings that they have there at Western Psych. And back then, there really wasn't NA yet. There was AA, and it was called the Midtown Group. And I came back, and I went to the meeting, and I thought, this is good, because I really don't drink. I could stay away from drinking. Maybe I'll just smoke pot, you know. And I went for a minute, and that was about it. And so it took me like 13 more years of the most horrendous life before I found a day clean. And I wasn't looking for a day clean. You know, when I done, in addiction, I wasn't like trying to stop. I wasn't trying to quit. I was cruising. I hooked up with some people, I don't know, you know, I can't call it the,
the entertainment industry. I was traveling the country with bands, selling T-shirts, rock concerts all over the country, sports events. Like, we'd get on a plane, get in the car. It was nothing to be like in L.A. the next day for the Stones tour or for Pink Floyd or back then REO Speedwagon. I mean, we met everybody. We partied with everybody. My wife, a couple of years ago, she put together this binder of all my like concert memorabilia of passes and autographs and pics and all that stuff. And it was kind of neat to see it, something that was just all stuff in a box. But that was an entire lifetime I lived on the road. And I wrestled with the idea of addiction because, like, I didn't shoot drugs on the road. I just made a lot of money, came home, and spent all that money I made. So we used to say, like, I got, like, my Benz and my Rolls, like, in one arm and the other arm. But we traveled. We had a lot of fun. Dabbled in overnight jails all over the country. And one time they tried to lock us up in Kansas, and they make their own laws in Kansas. And they had me in, like, 23-hour lockdown, federal counterfeiting. And I thought this ain't so bad, you know. Like, they're giving us, we got cigarettes, and the guys out, cups out, coffee, you know, with like coffee and all these Reader's Digest magazines. And I didn't think they could keep us, but that was my longest stretch in jail, and it was only 5 days. But they were pretty serious. And I had a call upon like a federal marshal I know, and I didn't have to rat nobody out, and they let us out. Because sometimes the laws that they make in Kansas don't hold out in the rest of the country. And I got to come home from Kansas. I ain't been back since, okay? They told us never come back either, do you? You know? And we don't want to see you again. Because we're just like, you know, working at a concert, and they got like guns to our heads, head on the foot of the car, holding pistols to our heads. And that's not a very good feeling. It wasn't the last time it ever happened, okay, but it wasn't a very good feeling. Somewhere in the mid-80s, you know, I was home, and one of my dad's business associates had this gig. He sold a lot of counterfeit goods, and I met some girls through him, and I met this hottest chick. And her friend too. And he said, you know, she really likes you. She thinks you're cute. And I don't know if I was cute then or what I was, but she was hot. And I ended up getting together with her. And I remember the first time I went to her house, and we were getting stoned, and she was getting ready for work. And I was like, she was like, she looked like a hairdresser, you know. She was just like that. She was way hot. And I said, like, where do you work? She says, well, I work in a massage parlor. I said, what do you do? She said, well, I suck and fuck. And I was like, this is the greatest. Boy, have I found my true, this girl is for me. And we had a long run, and we had a lot of fun. And you know, in hindsight, I can't call it fun because, you know, I was with her, and I was with her friend, and now I was helping out some of their friends, and I was, as my old sponsor says, I became like a union organizer. And then the police, like, caught on, and then the next thing you know, I got another gun to my head, and they're calling it white slavery, you know. It's like, kid from Squirrel Hill, you know, I'm not like a pimp. I'm just trying to help them out, you know. They need like protection. Like this little dude with this big shoulder holster, you know. It's like, I'm just trying to help them out. It's my girlfriend. I remember when I helped her cross that line because, you know, we snorted a lot of coke, and I was a dope shooter. And one day she said, Lynn, she come from addiction in her family, and she said, like, if you don't do it, I'll get somebody else to do it. And I plunged a needle in her arm for the first time.
as well as like well, I don't know, addiction, then our addiction like really took off. Well, somewhere in the travels, she got pregnant, and I stayed. And we had a little baby girl that didn't quite look like me when she come out, but she was so adorable. And we were so strung out, and taking the baby to the methadone clinic every day, and trying to get our lives together, and be like junkie parents. Didn't have nothing, didn't have diapers, didn't have anything. We were just trying to wing it, you know. And she was, you know, about a year old. She got pregnant again, and we had another baby girl. And same thing, born on the maternal addiction program, 21-day detox for a newborn baby. And we had no clue what we were doing, but we got two kids now, and we're strung out like research monkeys. And just living such a fucked up life. And within those next couple of years, turning points. Well, we lived on this corner in Squirrel Hill. Like, you know, you live in a world where you think nobody knows what you're doing, but everybody knows what you're doing. And there was this crossy guard on the corner, and, you know, polite to the crossy guard. She's wearing like a police uniform, you know. And I'd always be real polite to her. And one day she stuck a Bible in our car, and my lady says, like, "You're fucking her. I know you're fucking her." It's like, no, she's the crossy guard, you know. Just trying to be nice. Well, this lady ended up becoming, like, part of our lives. And I still, like, God placed her in life. She's the reason today I have my kids. Ta-da. Yeah, we were messed up. Like, they didn't send them kids home with no instruction manual or techniques or video or nothing. They just sent us home with these kids. We were living a really bad life, and she went from, like, a high-class call girl to a $20 broad on the avenue, and life was terrible. And I can tell you of the shame and the misery that came along with your old lady's a $20 broad. It was terrible. Life was terrible. That I'd have to hide with the kids in the basement. Like, she'd bring somebody home and we'd have to hide in this basement. We had this basement stacked full of dirty clothes because we didn't have no washer and dryer, you know. We didn't live in clean clothes. We lived in socks that weren't as dirty as other socks. And have to take the kids to the basement. We'd have to be very quiet because I didn't want to, because I wanted everything to go okay and I didn't want to have to kill anybody. And it was just a life of shame. And there's so many things and so many stories I could tell you of the shame and the guilt and the misery that we lived our lives, that somehow it was presented to us that you can get a chance to go get your lives together. And the crossy guard lady, who had six kids of her own, and her husband had fallen off a roof and died, and she said, "You can send your kids, can come live at our house while you two try to get your life together." And I went to get on the methadone, because I wasn't on the methadone, she was. Because remember, I didn't have a problem with drugs. I was just used drugs. Well, I went to the clinic. We both went to the clinic. I remember the day we broke up. The day that we had to separate was like a Memorial Day weekend. And she wouldn't get up to go get her take-home from the clinic, and I did. And, of course, when I got home, she wanted mine, and I couldn't give it to her. And she went a little berserk, and I had to have her put out of the house, and I had to get a PFA against her. And that's when I made a decision to change my life. So I've had to put her out of the house. The kids were safe. She'd go run the streets on her own. And I would go to the clinic every day and go to the Methadone Anonymous meeting and counseling and peeing a cup every day.
And I didn't really, at that point, I didn't know that there'd be a better way. I didn't know if I could get clean. I just knew that these kids are like a casualty, and they'll be a casualty of the system because we're going to be dead. We're going to be locked up. These kids are going to be what you see on TV, those adopted-out kids who are getting molested and abused. And somebody had to do this, and it didn't look like she was going to do it. So I got some help, and I stayed on methadone for 9 months. And 9 months gave me some structure, gave me some understanding of what the program was going to be. I still wasn't there yet. And I came, remember at the end of January of like 93, it was going into, towards the end of the month, and I was going out for a Super Bowl, to work at a Super Bowl and a Super Bowl parade, it was the, like 31st of January and toward through the 1st of February, and they wouldn't understand to give me take home and take home for the next 2 days of the month. They had their petty rules, and I had to say, you know what, I guess it's time, you know, and I walked off that clinic. And I traveled to Texas, and I was so sick trying to work with the crew at a Super Bowl parade, and I was like, I was really sick. And I came home, and it was Valentine's Day, February 14th, and I hadn't taken nothing since the 7th. I can't tell you, I remember the course of events, but February 7th was my clean date, last time I took a mind or mood altering drug. I came home on the 14th, and I thought, man, I got a cop, because I haven't slept in I don't know how long, and I'm so sick, and I thought, well, I can't cough in Hazelwood because then they'll all know I failed. So I'll just go to Larmer Avenue in Homewood. And I went to those old familiar alleys after not being there, you know, for a year, and faces changed, the game's still the same. And when I put my money out, they said, you're the police. We're not going to get out of here. It's like, no, I'm not. Like, it's like, they were going to kill me. And all I wanted to do was cop, but I wasn't a familiar face any longer. And I went to a meeting. Broke down, went to a meeting, you know. I went to Sunday Night Men's Group, Squirrel Hill, the Keep Coming Back group. And I was sick. And these guys said, you know, keep coming back, it'll get better. It's like, fuck you. I'm like, you don't know what I'm going through. You don't know me. Well, they did know me, and there were a lot of guys there that I knew, that I used with. They were all, like, happy, laughing. Hadn't seen them around in a while. Some of them I knew that they did something, you know, like whether they found God or whatever it was they did, they weren't in the game no more. And I went to the meeting. I said, hey, the meeting tomorrow night, it's at Forbes and Murray. Like, are you going to be there? Do you need a ride? I remember all those things that we still talk about today, grabbing the newcomer, you know. Hey, we're all going to Eaton Park. It's like, I ain't got no money. Don't worry about it. I didn't know about key tags and all that stuff. I remember, I must have got a key tag that night, you know. But I remember the people were giving me their phone numbers. I was like, bunch of faggots. I don't want these guys' phone numbers. I want girls' phone numbers. I want to meet the girls here. Why aren't they giving me their numbers? And I wasn't calling you. Don't give me your number. I ain't calling you anyway, you know. I went to meetings, and I didn't take nothing. I remember when I stood up for 30 days clean. I was so proud. I got one of those 30-day key tags, and I remember a couple nights later, this guy who had also stood up when I was clean 30 days, he was standing up again. I was like, motherfucker, you had 30 days like 4 days ago, you know? I didn't understand. You know, nobody told me the rules because I wasn't calling none of those people. I didn't know, like, you stand up for a week. But I kept coming. And it, 60 days and 90 days, I was starting to learn. And the 6 months, I thought, all them guys who said don't get in a relationship but until you're clean for a year, I thought that's because you wanted all these girls for yourself. And I learned a few lessons the hard way. You know, I dated in the program. And now I was dating a girl with a lot of years clean, you know. And years later, you know, I think, what the fuck was she doing with me? But I kept coming back, and I stayed. I didn't use. And it's today, 17 and a half years later, I haven't had a need to use. I can't tell you I did everything perfectly. I can't tell you I did everything righteous. But I didn't take nothing one day at a time. And after you have 30 days, I'm going to step one step back. I picked up that phone and called one of them numbers of these people. And then I started building a foundation of about 30 days clean. And I met a strong group of guys, you know, who are, you know, we don't come here all the same. We just all come here. And I met some good people that, you know, many of them are still my people today. Some of them didn't make it. I was clean a year, and, you know, I was at a club, not a recovery club. It was at Club Europa in Monroeville. And I scooped this really cute young girl. She was like, 35, she was like 23, and she had a little baby boy, and she was so cute. And she said, well, if you want to be with me, you have to have like a job. It's like, I never had a job. What do you mean, like a real job? Like, and I owe this to her today. I lost her, but somewhere I found the motivation to go to back to St. Francis, to where I'd been on their methadone clinic for 9 months, and they guided me towards vocational counseling. And what I remember, like, is that like where you put triangle blocks in a triangle hole and you answer questions? Whatever it is, like, they couldn't find nothing till my friend Rick spotted me, one of them guys from the South Hills, who I was going out to eat with and hanging with. And he said out of the blue, he said, are you looking for a job? It's like, how'd you know that? He said, well, I seen you around. He said, my company's hiring. I said, I have no idea what you do, but you drive a Cadillac, you wear a suit, and you're the happiest guy I know. Whatever it is, I'm interested. And he told me what he did for a living, and I thought it was kind of square, because I came from a world of, like, still traveled the country. I still even clean. I worked for bands. He's come watch me for a couple of days in my office. He says, you got a shirt and tie? It's like, do I have any ties that don't have blood on them? I'll come up with one, you know. I'll get one, don't worry. And I watched him in his office, and he introduced me that I'd be observing them today with his clients, his customers, his patients, and I took the interview, and we fudged up a resume. His sister helped us fudge up a resume, like to make like traveling the concerts into management skills. And I don't know how many people answered like ads in the paper for this job, but they hired me. I don't know what his part in that was, but it was God played his part, and they hired me and began to train me and showed me my way into the profession that I'm still in the same career today. And I owe it all to him spotting me at a meeting. He spotted a couple other guys at meetings too. In all these years that have gone by, I don't know where I'm going, but I know where I have been. And I know what my life was, and I never want to be that person again. Slowly but surely, like, I have changed. Somehow, I got old, fat, and square all at the same time, too. But my life has really changed. Now, I went to work, and I got custody of both my daughters. Again, no instruction manual, just... I was one of them dads with the backpack and the coloring books and the crayons and taking my kids to meetings. So that's why I never razz nobody when I see kids running to a meeting. I'll be the first to help you out with your kids because I was that dad. And I got custody of the girls when they were, little one was in diapers, older one was in preschool, and I had a job. I had a foundation. I had this little apartment. I know the ceiling was falling down and the floors were pulled up and plaster in my bed. Not crack plaster, you know, not that kind. That woman in the courts and my children's mother saw fit that I could take care of these kids. And I did. And shit, older daughter's 21, turns 22 on Monday. Younger daughter is 19 and a half. She just graduated from high school. And they've borne some of the grunt of the disease. Yeah, my younger daughter was learning disabled. And it was tough getting her through high school. But they're my girls, and they've been my girls. And I can't tell nobody else the story, but their mother ain't here to talk about them. She got a moment clean here and there. She'd come to meetings, she'd hook up with somebody who's clean, and she'd get a moment or two here or there, but she died in that misery that addiction promises you. If you keep using, you will die. She did go to jail. She did die. To take my daughters to bury their mother is such a sad thing to do. And maybe I hope that they understand that if you do this, this is what will happen to you. Like that they have a foundation that drugs, crime doesn't pay, drugs don't pay. Here's the end. And you don't have to waste your whole life like I did using drugs. They don't use drugs. But my older daughter, she drinks. Boyfriend owns a club, nightclub, and she's not fast, and they're not getting high. Just for today, you know, I don't know what's down the road, but I try to give them morals, values, judgment. They see the life that I live. Sometimes, you know, a single dad, it was like our house is like a combination between all the sitcoms I grew up watching and all the ones of the day, you know. So we're a little like Andy Griffith. We're a little like All in the Family. We're a little like Al Bundy and his kids. And we're just like, I learned everything I learned from watching TV. I still didn't get a manual, you know. I should have requisitioned one somewhere, but you know, I raised my kids like a sitcom. Somewhere down the road, I hooked up with what I thought, spotted a hot chick, you know, in the program. Thought it was time to settle down. I went a few years without dating. When my daughters were little, I didn't date because maybe it was pointed out to me that, like, it was a bad influence. Look what you're showing your growing daughters, and you can't have girls come spend the night. You just can't do this. And but I spotted one, and she was kind of hot, and I asked my friend about her, and he said, yeah, she's pregnant. And you can't date a pregnant girl. Especially she was like divorced, disillusioned, moved to the big city and carrying some guy's baby that the moment she said she was pregnant, he packed his toothbrush and left. We became friends, and after little boy was born, we dated and we got married, and I've been his father for 12 years now. And he's the greatest kid in the whole freaking world. He's tops, man. And she has an older son, so I have a stepson. He's away at college now. He goes to St. Vincent's in La Trobe. An older daughter goes to community and nursing school. And
younger daughter works at Panera and wants, we'll start a class in the winter term, take one class at college because that's probably will work for her. She's still trying to find herself on what she wants to be when she grows up. Don't wait as long as I waited, you know. It took me till I was like 36. We have a wonderful life. Yeah, I divorced that girl a year and a half or so ago. Well, she, again, I can't tell her story, you know. Put her through nursing school. She became an RN. We took on all that obligation, and somehow she thought that that medicine that holds the pills, the machine that holds the pills in the hospital, was like a Pez machine. And so she lost her job, lost her career, went to rehab, let her go to rehab. I tried to forgive. I couldn't forget. In rehab, she met some dude that understood her because I was clean for so long. I don't understand anymore. And she had to go. Simple as that. So, yeah, in the same motion, I was buying a company. I was divorcing her. I was taking on the house we had just purchased. And my daughters both living at home. And you know what? I handled it. I didn't take nothing. And I prayed and I talked to my sponsor and I talked to people about it. And it, you know, I could look back. If you told me it was, you know, if you're telling me your story, I'd just be sitting there going, oh, wow. But you got to do what you got to do. I still go to a lot of meetings. Like, I could tell you that I go like Tuesday to my home group. Wednesday I was a Hazelwood home group member, but I took on a commitment at a state correctional facility in Fayette County. And there I'm there on Wednesday and Thursday, sometimes at the early meeting in Greenfield, and Friday I'm in the Mon Valley at Mr. Clean, and Saturday I'm at Jefferson, Sunday sometimes the early meeting in Greenfield, and I don't go to meeting on Monday because there's real good TV on Monday night. I got to see like 2 and a Half Men. Rules of Engagement. All my shows are on Monday night, so I don't go nowhere Monday. I just learned to stay clean a day at a time. I try to look for help. Sometimes it's hard for me to ask. Like, I purchased a company. I'm like CEO, chief cook and bottle washer. You know, I think of these monumental things like when a bank lent you the money to buy your first car. It's like, and I'm going to pay you back. And you make payments on a car. When the first, I was clean like 1 year and I got a car. It wasn't a $200 car, you know. And when we bought a house, even though I didn't know she was using while we were shopping for a house, we bought this wonderful house in the suburbs in a beautiful community. No crack dealers on any corner. And they lent me the money to buy that house. And when I wanted to buy a business, I found financial backing that was willing to say, we have faith in you. We think you could do it. We'll lend you the money. Yeah, I came to a point in the same career. And I've worked for a bunch of different people because I have trouble with authority still. Even though some of my best friends are all policemen now. I still have trouble with you telling me what to do. Employers weren't making like suggestions. They were making like, this is what we want you to do or we're not going to pay you. So just like we start new meetings with a resentment, coffee pot and a resentment, like I bought the company with over a resentment and I got a coffee pot. One of them Keurigs, put the individual pods in. So yeah, resentment and coffee pot. And I bluffed my way into owning this company. So I own this big company. I have no fucking clue what I'm doing some days. But God's been very good to me. And I do ask for help. And, you know, I came in not knowing how to really use a computer. When I were teaching computers when I was in college, I thought, this thing will never catch on. I don't know who they're kidding. Like, who are these people going to get jobs with? NASA? I would never envision. My life revolves around all the computers that I use every day. I have payroll, I have a banker, I have an attorney, I have an investment counselor. Plus, I have a sponsor, a home group, a foundation. But I need professional help, you know. I don't need counseling and psychologists anymore. I just need help. I need an IT person who can teach me how to build this website that when you go to my company, it says under construction because I don't know how to do it. But I've been blessed with a life so far beyond that junkie, pimp, drug dealer, gypsy who traveled the country in search of, like, the next one. I'm not that guy today. I don't know what time it is, but it's time. I'm here to tell you that, like, I learned to live life one day at a time. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I've lived such a wonderful life and so many lives, not like a cat using all my 9 lives, but if I died, whoever came to mourn my loss would be saying, what a piece of shit, I'm so glad he's gone. And I don't need that because I ain't going to know, but I'm not a piece of shit on the bottom of your shoe today. Just an addict in recovery, trying to stay clean, trying to behave, pay my taxes, obey the laws, don't speed often. Pay almost all of my bills. Love my children. Take care of their needs the best I can. So I raised 2 teenage daughters. I just show up today. About the retreat, like I got involved when that wife was like a couple years clean, her sponsor was the chair of the retreat. So she pulled me in. So for the last 9 or 10 years, I've been on the retreat committee, Spirit Tri-State Regional. I've done every position that I wanted to do over and over again. Vice chair last year, chair this year. This year beat the crap out of me. Didn't have a whole lot of support or help or people who wanted to be on committees. We thought about abandoning the retreat this year and making it every other year. I quit. Once this year, I was gone, fall through the winter. I had another issue going on in my life, and that's a whole other story. But I left, and there was nobody to fill the position. There was no retreat. So I came back and reapplied, went for election again. And we put this thing together, flying by the seat of our pants. Because the guy before me didn't give me no instruction manual either, okay? And we pulled it off, and it was a wonderful retreat, and everybody had a good time, and I never want to do it again, and I don't want to go to another board of directors or region meeting. I'm done. So I hope there are others that will take upon commitments, because you all got to realize that if you don't take part in service till it beats the crap out of you, you don't want to do it no more, if you don't take part, like, this retreat, this picnic, these things can't happen unless you say, hey, you know what? I could take on a position. Thanks. Get involved with service. Have a home group. Do something more than make the coffee. Sometimes you stay clean long enough, you got to do a little bit more than show up. And I do a lot more than show up today. But for the rest of this year, I just want to show up. They asked me to be part of the convention. It's like, thanks. Taking a break. Doesn't mean I'll take a break forever, just right now. I can't do it any longer. If this is being recorded, they're going to know that, too. Hey, thank you for sitting through this heat, this humidity, and hearing, like, just some squirrel trying to get a nut here, just an addict trying to get a day clean. Said, come to our picnic. Yeah, I only live a couple hours away. Did I think about that for a moment? No. Thank you for asking me to speak. Thank you
Rick for thinking enough that I might have a message of recovery to share, and I hope that I said something that nobody uses today. Thanks.